Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Welcome to the Currency Weekend podcast. I'm Dion Fanning. The situation in Ukraine remains tense and uncertain. The books of our guest this weekend, Serhii Ploiy, offer an insight into the historical context of the region. And if you've read any of them, or East West Street or Bloodlands, you will be aware of the forces and tussles involved, the competing nationalisms in the region, and the importance to Vladimir Putin of Ukraine and Kiev in particular in Russian identity. Serhii Ploiy is professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard. He has written many books on Ukraine, Russia, Chernobyl, and the fall of the Soviet Union. The Gates of Europe deals with the history of Ukraine, and The Lost Kingdom is a book about the Russian Empire and Russian nationalism. It also deals with what Ukraine means to Vladimir Putin and why a statue of an 11th century Ukrainian leader was erected in Moscow under his rule. Putin believes that Russians and Ukrainians are the same, but Serhii Ploiy says he does not believe that Russians are Ukrainians. He believes that Ukrainians are Russians. Lydia and Catherine, it's very good to be talking to you today, although obviously not in very good circumstances. Lydia, can I talk to you first? Can you tell me, as a Ukrainian, how it feels watching what's been happening over the last 24 hours?
Thank you. Actually, it's very mixed feeling. Of course, terrifying, but also with a piece of admiration about the people and how they are doing and how they are standing and about their spirit of fighting, but also mobilizing. But of course, it's terrifying to observe in 2022 the events like this, what is going on now in Ukraine. This is something nobody ever would believe we would live through, even though we have lived two revolutions.
And what is it about that? Because that was something that framed the last few weeks of conversation. Reports from Ukraine and from Kiev were very different in terms of what the people on the ground were saying. They didn't expect this invasion, even though there was, you know, American intelligence, Western intelligence saying this was imminent. So has it been particularly shocking for people in Ukraine to actually turn into a reality?
If I will put it shortly, of course, it was shocking. But Ukrainians were preparing for that, especially after Maidan Revolution. The way it has happened, of course, it was not surprising, but nobody wanted the war. So the way it has happened is quite shocking, because nobody has expected, indeed, to live through war nowadays. Even though, considering the last events, of course, Ukrainians were mentally, but also military preparing and preparing for that it would have happened.
Catherine, can I talk to you? And I feel like there is you are like a renowned academic, and you're a historian of Eastern Europe, but we like to give a bit of background. Like I contacted Lydia yesterday, and then Lydia put together a podcast with the two of you, which we're now expanding into this conversation. But it was distressing. It was distressing listening to that podcast that the two of you did yesterday, because you were both upset, and it did capture that sense of despair that not just people in Ukraine feel, but people around in Europe and in the world feel at what is happening now. And I think more emotion in some ways, because I think there is a sense of some sort of sense of having been complacent or having been duped or in some way, like certain people, you know, there is just this sense of allowing this to happen in a way that shouldn't have happened. Can you explain to me how you feel about that and the emotion that you were feeling yesterday, and 24 hours later, maybe how you're feeling now?
First and foremost, I am heartbroken at what Ukrainians are experiencing right now. I'm heartbroken that they, who have worked so hard over the past 8 years, but also after over the past 30 years of Ukrainian independence, to build a pluralist society, a society that is committed to so many of the values that we all around profess to hold dear. I'm heartbroken that they are having to bear the brunt of this because we did not step in sooner, offer them as much help as we could. We did not recognize in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea and invaded Eastern Ukraine, we did not recognize the reality of what was going on at the time. There was too much ambivalence rooted in misinformation, in not misinformation, more like disinformation, honestly. Whataboutism, all of these political divisions that sprung up that prevented us from having a united response then. And again, we're watching, even as Ukrainians are dying, we're watching the world struggle to come to a united response now.
And why is that? Because I interviewed Serhiy Plokhii about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and he made that exact point that what is needed now is unity. And what is needed is a strong response and an acknowledgement of the right to for Ukrainian people to decide whether they want to be part of NATO, whatever they want. They have a right as an independent nation to decide that. And even up until 2 or 3 days ago, we were hearing, nobody has any plans for Ukraine to become part of NATO. It was being negotiated away, and now maybe that's off the table. But why is it so hard still, do you think, just to achieve that united front?
I think there are two reasons that I would identify why it's so hard for there to be a united front in a response to Russia's aggression right now. The first of those has to do with long-standing attempts on Putin's part, but also on others, to create a false mythology that presents Russia and Ukraine as part of one brotherly nation. This is a falsehood, this is mythology, and yet because it has been being pushed for so long now, there is a certain sense in which it has crept into the popular understanding. But I would say that perhaps more relevant here is a failure to recognize that what happens in Ukraine really does affect all of us. A war on Ukraine is in some ways a war on all of us, right? These values that Ukrainians have emulated, right? They looked to Europe, they looked to the EU. The last people who really believed optimistically, utopianly in the EU were in some senses Ukrainians, right? It felt like this is a project that is worth working towards. And we didn't live up to those values that we profess to hold. And so the failure to recognize that Ukrainians are committed in this way to these things, I think, is what's preventing unity from really surfacing. The last thing I would say is that there's also very practical concerns here, right? What we're seeing, unsurprisingly, is the countries within Europe, just to focus on Europe, that are most resistant to a very strong response are those countries that have the deepest financial ties with Russia, business community, all of these sorts of things. There are legacies there, reasons, practical reasons there as well.
And is that important too? Because one of the things that seemed to be the argument that seems to be going in favor of or against the idea of an invasion was that whilst Putin didn't invade, Europe could be fractured in terms of how they would respond. But once he invaded, there would be a united response. Now, that again is showing up to be naive, because as you say, there are differences within the EU. Donald Tusk has tweeted on Friday saying that, you know, countries like Germany, Italy and Hungary have disgraced themselves. So even as he does this, Putin is still sowing discord within the EU. So he is achieving his ambitions within Ukraine, but he is also achieving his ambitions of destabilizing the EU.
This is an extremely important point, right? While we recognize that Ukraine is the main focus here, subduing Ukraine because he does not see it as a legitimate state is his primary aim, that doesn't mean he doesn't also have plenty of other things he wouldn't mind accomplishing along the way. Sowing discord within the EU is one of those. Scaring the other countries in the region is another. Proving the extent to which NATO is really willing to back up its security guarantees is another. All of these things are pieces in the puzzle that he's trying to assemble.
Lydia, can you talk to me a bit about the falsehood that Catherine mentioned there? The idea, again, that Putin advanced this week about, you know, Ukraine being a product entirely of the Soviet Union. And can you talk to me again, about the truth and about Ukraine as a country and the history and the identity and why and its modern iteration as well?
Yes, Ukraine was always there, and the history of modern Ukraine, as we know, the whole country started after the collapse of Soviet Union, but it doesn't mean that some basis for this history were not there. And as we know, like Ukraine, as we know it today, started from Kyiv Rus, and Moscow was founded much later on. And within itself, Ukraine has a very various identity on different levels as religious, as language level. So Ukraine is a full sovereign and diverse country.
And that obviously is like to say it's under threat right now is an understatement. But can you explain what, as we speak on Friday, you know, there are Russian the Russian army is outside Kyiv. What is at stake in terms of, you know, obviously, just what is at stake for Ukraine and for the people in the next 48 hours and then beyond that?
I think the main hope is to mobilize. A lot of people have left Kyiv for the security reason, or a lot of people are staying underground, of course, to protect their life and beloved one. A lot of people trying to leave the places, but I think the main thing is just to stand and to rely on the military forces. And not to panic, of course, because during this 8 years, the military forces has become very trained and are able to protect Ukrainians. But also what I can observe also from here, talking with my friends, family, the way and the sense of unity is extremely high. And this is very admirable, because people helping each other all over, people helping in some sense how and what they can to the military forces as well. So I am sure they will for sure stand this 48 hours. And I think they believe in the best, and it will happen the best. But the main thing is just not to panic and to spread the solidarity and protect themselves as much as they can on the whole levels, psychological, but also simply physical level, because the situation is critical.
Like we're seeing already like incredible examples of heroism, you know, from Ukrainian soldiers, but from Ukrainian civilians as well, confronting the Russian army in different ways. And that does speak to what you're saying there about this sense of purpose. But I wonder, again, how people in Ukraine that you are speaking to, Lydia, how they feel about what is happening. Again, the reaction, maybe we can excuse it prior to the last 24 hours, but that seems a little bit weak as well. But certainly since, again, that we're still waiting for those real, you know, shows of unity, like the sanctions that are weak, that are you know, they're still saying we're holding some back. I don't know what they're holding them back for. What is the reaction? We've seen it from Zelensky, but what is the reaction from the people you're talking to about those, about the sanctions or the lack of them?
The reaction mainly is angriness, because of course I think Ukrainians are realizing that they are left in this war, but also a big hope and beliefs that still people can see that it's there and it's for real. And mainly also the European position would be united and more active, proactive position in the sense of not only observing, making statements, but also going to the active actions.
Catherine, what do you expect to happen? Like, you know, you've talked there about the various elements of Putin's strategy, but how do you expect it to evolve in terms of what Lydia talks about there and you know, the response from Europe? Because there again, there, you know, there is likely to be as this progresses, and as you know, is one of the scary, terrifying things, as you know, Ukrainians demonstrate that bravery that Lydia talks about, it's going to become a more emotive subject for lots of people, and people in the EU are going to want action, as citizens are going to want action. But will their governments, do you feel, respond to that, or is it going to be those economic necessities as various governments in the EU see it?
I'm no idealist when it comes to citizens' ability to impact what their governments decide to do. So to be perfectly honest, in my own personal capacity, I'm quite pessimistic here. At the same time, I think that doesn't absolve us of the responsibility to individually, as individual people, do as much as we can to put pressure, right? Not only to put pressure on our governments to do things, but also to find ways in our own lives. So for example, here at the Institute, we are ramping up our practical solidarity with Ukraine. We are expanding the fellowships that we offer to Ukrainian scholars. We are calling on other institutions across Europe to do the same thing. Right now, that feels like one of the crucial things that we can do. We can continue to press for these high level actions, but we also need to be ready to support Ukrainians however we can.
Can you talk to me a little bit, Catherine, there about this? About the institute that you're both in at the moment in Vienna. Can you explain to me what that does? Because it is it sounds like an extraordinary place.
So the Institute for Human Sciences was founded in 1982, so 40 years ago this year, as a meeting place for dissident scholars from Eastern Europe and their counterparts from Western Europe. It's a place that has always been predicated on the importance of dialogue and exchange between disciplines as well as across geographies. It focuses on a free intellectual exchange with the sort of through line that we are always in search of truth. We are always centering the notion of human dignity in the intellectual work that we do. So we host around 100 visiting fellows from all over the world each year. We organize public facing programs that help to bring the most pressing issues of the day into broader discussion and to give those this sort of intellectual grounding rather than allowing them to be simple policy discussions, for example.
And that is something, as you say, you're going to accelerate there in terms of Ukraine now with the events of the last few days.
Exactly. So since 2015, of course, in the wake of the Maidan and in response to the Russian annexation of Crimea and invasion of Eastern Ukraine, we've had a program here called Ukraine and European Dialogue, which does precisely that. Over these past years, we've hosted over 50 fellows, organized countless events, publications, anything we can do to demonstrate solidarity with Ukraine, but also to insist that what Ukrainians have experienced over these past 8 years and what they will continue to experience is valuable for all of us to understand better, right? It's not simply the case that Ukrainians come here to learn from us. In fact, it's usually the other way around. We have so much to learn from Ukrainians, and that will continue to be the case.
And can you speak, Catherine, as well on that, what you feel is the, like, there are a number of theories about where Putin's strategy ends here, where he's going, or if you feel there is a thought out strategy at this stage, because like there is, and it's become a kind of, seems to be a sort of slightly out of fashion concept, the idea that somebody just kind of is acting in an irrational sense without any clear strategy, seems to be part of this, the thought process, again, looking at what he's done over the last while. Is, where do you see it ending, or where do you think he sees it ending?
I have for many years now tried so hard not to understand what's going on in his head. I think it's not a game that we can win necessarily. I think you're right to emphasize that he is not a fully rational actor here. That is clear. His sentiments towards Ukraine are not those of rational calculus. The reality is that even there's no way that Putin can win the war for Ukraine, right? Ukrainian identity and Ukrainians' commitment to their state is not something that's going to go away because of a military victory on Russia's side. This is something that is going to persist, that any future constellation is going to have to reckon with. This is, we should expect Ukrainians to continue to strive for, fight for, do everything they can to assert their right to exist in years to come.
Lydia, how does it feel to you when you see the protests of people in Russia to what is going on? Because I've seen some mixed feelings from Ukrainians about it, but I don't know what how you feel about it when you see that. Is it something that gives you some hope?
It makes me feel actually finally, I think the word, it's just simple, but also very bright, finally. And of course it gives hope. And of course, a lot of Ukrainians were appealing to Russians from Sunday, that this is the first thing what actually Russian citizens has to do. Just to stand up, speak out, because this is there and this is for real. So it feels for me very good that they went to a protest, because it showed the solidarity. Unfortunately, too little and too small.
And is it something you feel there's anything to build on? Because like one of the ideas put forward, and I saw it being put forward by a reporter in London on Thursday, speaking to a cabinet minister in the UK cabinet, saying that the intention of the sanctions is to sort of lead to a sort of a palace coup where some in Putin is overturned. But Lydia, do you feel that is something that with protests on the street, there is any chance of an isolated Putin being removed from office?
Well, actually, I am optimistic, so, and participating by myself in Maidan, Ukrainian Revolution 2014, which me and a lot of Ukrainians think that was ultimately point of no return, of no any possibility to come back to any dictatorship government. I do have a hope that once Russians all over will raise up and stand up, it could change something. So I would rather question open and dreamy a little bit, because the practice show us the other way around. But yes, I do hope it could change.
And what do you think are for, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky has been very articulate and very like it's been, again, quite moving watching him this week talking about things, and but it seems, again, it's kind of haunting watching it now, because nobody knows, the future for him seems so uncertain and so unclear. I wonder what you feel about him, how he is leading in this crisis, in this invasion, Lydia.
Me myself and a lot of Ukrainians also, once we are talking about the president of our country and the way he is communicated as abroad, as also inside the country, we do feel solidarity and pride about the way of communication, direct, strong, but also it takes a lot of courage to address the issue and to talk directly among others about European sanction, about European solidarity, that there is no enough action, that there is no enough unity from the West side. And from the other point of view, it's also admirable that he is appealing also to diverse layers of citizenship, as well as trying to communicate very cold-minded, but also with a full empathy and realization of what is going on in situation, but also keep the spirit going. So it is very admirable, and it is very good. And what I'm talking with my friends and colleagues and people in Ukraine, it functions nice and supportive. Yes.
Catherine, we talked a lot about Europe and the EU, but how do you feel President Biden has handled the situation? Because, you know, on one hand, America were very strong in talking about this invasion was imminent, and that was their intelligence, and that has proved to be correct. But on the other hand, there seems to be, you know, there's this sort of deadening moment when you sense that there is a very very clear limit to what the US, like the EU, are prepared to do. And I wonder how you feel Biden has done in this crisis.
Personally, I've been quite impressed by Biden, by the strength of his comments, his remarks, by the US intelligence, by the way that they are in fact leaking that intelligence, right? I think all of these have been savvy strategies. Now, all of this is much more true for the moment up until yesterday. And here, I think what we're seeing is perhaps more a reflection of problems within the American political system, which, as we know, is completely riddled with its own internal obsessions, its own internal divisions, polarization, really horrible things that are going on. And some of that has to do with the way that techniques that Putin pioneered have actually been imported into US politics, right? The Republican Party at this point has a significant contingent that has adopted many of Putin's same tactics of manipulating the truth, of completely inverting the truth, right? It goes beyond manipulation to complete inversion. And so when you get to a question like this, there's not a true fair basis for coming to mutual agreement and decisions.
And that infects everything, including this, where you have people, and I think it is instructive how many people in America, in Europe, in Ireland, who have been exposed for that sort of Putin adjacent position, they've been exposed especially during the last 48 hours.
Yeah. I mean, you look at Donald Trump, you know, he's all in favor of this, right? And it's not surprising. And given the way that US politics now are trending, it's not surprising that there are plenty of people within the Republican Party who are going right alongside him. But this is not my area of expertise. I speak here entirely as a distressed citizen.
I know. Lydia, look, I'm going to let you go because I've taken a lot of your time, and you've been very good to do this. But I would just like to ask you before we finish, what message would you send to people in business in Ireland, in citizens in Ireland, in political life in Ireland and around Europe? What message would you send to them today in terms of what they can do to help Ukraine?
I think it is three points which you could help. It's spread the message, demand from your local government to pay attention on the Ukrainian issues, but also support Ukrainian people in the way of this too, but also donation. This are simply and easy as that, but very, very, very helpful.
Okay. Catherine, Lydia, thank you so much for your time today, and best of luck, and our thoughts are with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.